Well, good morning, Sunnyside. Good morning, wake up the world. I always look forward to this weekend every year because we get to merge everything together. Sunnyside gets their free ticket to the closing session of Wake Up the World. Wake Up the World gets to experience life at Sunnyside. It's a great merger, and I figured, why stop there? This year, we're going to merge what Wake Up the World's been covering this whole weekend and what Sunnyside's been doing through our Lent series on the teachings of Jesus from the Sermon on the Mount, and we're going to mush that all together because Wake Up the World has been focusing on the goodness of God. We picked that specifically because it was our 10th anniversary of the conference. For those of you that have been journeying with us through those 10 years, thank you. Thank you for the support, for the prayers. Again, I still have to pinch myself to believe that we're at 10 years already. When we started this, we had no children, and now we have three. And that's made life interesting, trying to run a conference and manage children at the same time. But we thank you for your support, for your prayers. But today, we are going to look at the goodness that heals the heart. Because as I said, all weekend we've been looking at this theme of the goodness of God. We've sung about it, we've prayed about it, we've heard testimony about it, we've reflected on it, and yet if we're honest with ourselves, it's really easy to celebrate God's goodness when everything is going right. How many of you would agree that it is great, it's so easy to thank God for his goodness when things are going right? You know, It's easy to say, God, you are so good when our prayers are being answered in the way that we want them to be answered. It's so easy to trust when our relationships are healthy, and it's easier to believe when our circumstances are favorable. But what about those situations in our life where that's not the case? When things break, when things are dark. I want to share a story with you. It's a recent story in my life. This past fall, I went through a pretty dark time. Some of you may have known that, some of you may not. I wasn't making it public just because I was journeying through it with myself, my family, and some mentors to get through it. But what happened was I was driving home. We had worked a wedding. We were driving home one night, and within the last 5 minutes of our trip, I just had a complete anxiety attack, completely broke down. I ended up getting home and was crying on the bathroom floor, and I had no idea why. This has happened to me once before, and at that point I was diagnosed with severe clinical depression, and that was a 6-year journey, and I was like, I don't want to go down that road again. And so the next morning, it was Sunday morning, I was here, and I spoke with Pastor Drew and Pastor Amy, and together they have supported me through this season. What was happening was I had this unexpected anxiety that came out of nowhere, and I couldn't explain it. We're dealing with some family health concerns at home and journeying alongside my in-laws through that. And it's been a lot of extra support that we've had to pour out as well, and so been draining on that. As well as I was going in this season, I was doubting myself. I wasn't doubting God. I wasn't doubting God's work. I wasn't doubting God's goodness. But I was doubting the choices that I've made in my life. Main one being a pastor. And the implications and the stress that that puts on my family. I agreed to do this. We did talk for a number of months before I became a pastor. And Sam did sign on for it. And she was all good with it. But just this idea came into my head again, like, you shouldn't be a pastor. You should go back to baking, go back to working in accounting, go back to administration somewhere else. And through these conversations with these mentors, both here at the church and as well as on our district, I was able to get the help and the support that I needed. And what we actually found out was this was pre-burnout. That's where we were at. If I hadn't have found help then, I can't say that I'd be standing here before you today. I may have needed to be on a sabbatical for a longer period of time. But the cool thing was, in all of that, in those dark nights when it was so hard to pray, to thank God for his faithfulness and his goodness and his hope, there was a light at the end of the tunnel. God's goodness showed up in all these people that have been placed in my life to support me through that. And through setting healthier boundaries and having the difficult conversations, God's goodness has continued to show up and has brought me through to a much healthier place today. And as I look back, I can see how God's goodness was evident and how he was working beneath the surface, even when I couldn't see that. He was shaping me, protecting my family, and guiding me towards this restoration that has taken place. And that's what we're going to look at today in Matthew 5. So if you have your Bibles with you, a Bible app, I always encourage you to follow along on your own device or Bible so you can make notes as we go. It will be on the screen. But we're going to be looking at verses 21 to 24, a short section of that passage. But this, again, is from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Starting at verse 21, it says, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder.' And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, 'Raca,' is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at an altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift in front of the altar. First, go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift." From this short passage today, it is my hope that together we will discover that the goodness of God is not shallow, that it is not sentimental, it's not surface level. It's a goodness that heals the heart, and it works even when life gets messy and painful. And I want to do that by exploring three different things from this passage in order to understand God's goodness that heals our heart and how we can experience that in the here and now. So if you've got something to take notes, maybe you want to jot these headings down as we go, or maybe come back to this later on YouTube or Right Now Media. The sermons will be up there this next week. But the first point I want to make is God's goodness goes beneath the surface. Look again at verse 21 and the first part of 22. "You've heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder,' and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment." Jesus starts off this part of the passage by referencing back to the sixth commandment, back in Exodus 20:13, when he says, "You shall not murder." Now, the Greek word that he is using here in Matthew's gospel for murder, I'm going to butcher this, I apologize, it is phanuo, which refers specifically to the unlawful killing. It's not some accidental death, it's not warfare, it is the deliberate taking of an innocent life. Every person that was listening on that hillside understood how severe this was. It was part of the foundation of their law. It was clear if you had not taken a life, you were considered obedient to the law in that respect. But Jesus here is not correcting the commandment. He's actually restoring the depth that it has. If we go back a few more verses, we'll look back at verse 17. It says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." See, what he's doing here is he's revealing the full weight and intention behind this. Because in the religious culture in those days, righteousness was often measured by the observable behavior of someone. If your hands were clean, you were considered righteous. If you had not physically committed murder, you were safe. Go to verse 20. And verse 20 says, "Unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." Out of nowhere, Jesus makes this startling statement. See, the Pharisees in those days were meticulous about their outward appearance and doing all the right things so people would observe that. And people are now thinking, okay, if you're making this statement, how then are we ever going to attain that? How is that even possible? And the answer to that is not in strict rule-keeping. The answer is actually found in something different. The answer is found in deeper transformation. So Jesus takes this idea of murder and this theme of murder, and he's like, you know what? We're going to trace this backwards because murder doesn't just happen. There's a root to it. And so we're going to back it up. And what does he say in the second part of that passage? He says that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. The Greek word here for angry is translated to orgizo. This does not refer to some just brief flash of irritation. It describes this settled, ongoing anger, a smoldering resentment of sorts that's allowed to take up residence in our heart. And it's this kind of anger that's rehearsed, protected, and justified over time that Jesus is referencing. But he wants to reveal something profound here, because the external act of murder begins long before the external act ever even occurs. It begins with the orgizo. It begins with that anger that is nurtured internally, the act that is visible, but the root is hidden. In Hebrew culture, their thought of the heart was not simply the emotional center of a person. They thought of the heart as the control center of a person. That was the place where your thoughts, your will, your intentions and desires all came from. So when Jesus is addressing anger in a heart, he's not minimizing murder. He's pointing to the origin. And this is where the goodness of God becomes visible in this passage. Because God's goodness does not wait until destruction happens. He doesn't just intervene only after lives become shattered. He addresses the seed before it grows to fruition. Because if righteousness were merely behavioral, then avoiding murder would solve it all. But God desires wholeness, not mere compliance. And he goes beneath the surface. So Jesus goes on to say that this sustained anger makes a person subject to judgment. And this word refers to the literal legal accountability that they have, the kind that's handled in the local courts of the Jewish society. In other words, Jesus is intensifying the seriousness of this internal hostility, not because anger carries the same earthly consequences as murder, but because both flow from the same corrupted root. Not out of condemnation, but out of mercy. Think about it this way. How many of you have had the privilege in your life to see an actual iceberg? Oh, a couple of you. Okay. That's on my bucket list. How many of you would say the only iceberg I've seen is in Titanic? Ah, there we go. There's the truth. But okay, think about an iceberg though, okay? I think we all know this. Only a small tip rises above the water. That's what everybody sees. But 90% of the iceberg is below the surface. And this hidden portion is where the real danger actually lies. And this is how anger and bitterness and resentment work in our life. What looks small on the surface can have this immense destructive power below. But God's goodness intervenes below the surface. See, he doesn't wait for the explosion. He doesn't wait for the ship to crash into it. He goes straight for the heart before the iceberg tips and causes damage in your life. And anger that is left unattended, as we all know, it grows and it festers and it shapes how we react to situations and people in our life. For our middle schoolers here today, it might look like snapping at a friend or a sibling for something small, but the underlying issue that caused that was just the stress of school. For our young adults, it may be carrying disappointment of relationships or jobs quietly simmering under the surface. Our adults may endure stress and resentment from work and relationships or parenting. Our seniors, this may look like carrying decades of unresolved grief, regret, and disappointment. But God's goodness searches beneath the surface because he loves us too much to leave the iceberg hidden. He addresses what's forming within us before it hardens into something destructive. It's not harshness, it's out of kindness, because it's from a father who cares enough about his children to not leave them in that situation. Proverbs 29:11 says, "Fools give full vent to their rage, but the wise bring calm in the end." Or James 1:19-20, everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry, because human anger does not produce the righteousness God desires. And Psalm 34:18 tells us, the Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. These verses show us that God's goodness is proactive. He steps in early before the anger and the resentment become destructive in our lives. I remember a time in my own life, this would have been when I was back in high school. I lived in Trenton at the time, and I was harboring some built-up anger and resentment for some leaders in our church. No one here at that church. Make that clear, okay? And over time, I kept this grudge for months. And on the surface, when they saw me on Sunday, I was polite. I was the nicest person to be around. But under the surface, this was bubbling and boiling up inside me. And I was rehearsing what I would say if I ever had the time. I was gonna bite their head off. I was ready. I was at that point. But there was one night that for some reason, I don't know why, God was just like, hey, what's going on? What is this? Let's unpack this together. And in that night with wrestling with God, he revealed what's been going on inside. He revealed the root of this anger. And I was able in that moment to see how this was affecting me and how this could affect them, which I hadn't cared how it was going to affect them when I blew up at them. But he showed the repercussions and the consequences. And in doing that, I was able to see God's goodness, because he proactive came in and dealt with it before it blew up. And I was able to then go and sit down with this person and say, hey, listen, I've been feeling this way for the past number of months because of this thing that you did. And I am so sorry that I felt this way, and I want to, you know, be reconciled to you. And we want to rebuild this relationship. And they had no idea that it was going on, but we were able to rebuild that relationship and that friendship, and God's goodness has strengthened that friendship, and they are still friends to this day, and still both of us now serving God in different churches, and it's wonderful how God didn't leave me in that mess and wait for it to blow up, because that would have gone, like I said, sideways. But this takeaway is simple from this passage, from this story, that whatever anger and frustration you're facing, the best thing to do is to take it to God before it boils over. Pray about it. Journal it. Maybe talk with a trusted mentor and friend. But let God intervene before it hardens your heart or damages your relationships. His goodness goes beneath the surface, not to shame you, but to heal you. So maybe ask yourself these questions this morning. What icebergs might be forming beneath the surface of your heart? And are there feelings that you've been ignoring that God wants you to surrender today? Because God's goodness goes beneath the surface. Second thing is, God's goodness takes the heart seriously. Look at verse 22, the second portion. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raca, is answerable in the court. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fires of hell. Raca is not a Greek word here. Now, it's an Aramaic insult, actually. Aramaic was the common spoken language of the people at that time. And the word Raca essentially means empty-headed, worthless, good for nothing. It attacked the person's intelligence and dignity and became dismissive and degrading. And then Jesus goes on and says, you shall not say you fool. Well, the word translated fool comes from the Greek word moros. Sound familiar? That's where we get our word moron. Now, it's not meaning stupidity in this sense. It's implying moral corruption, someone who's spiritually bankrupt, someone rebellious towards God. And so what Jesus is doing is he's showing a progression here, that anger settles in the heart, then it finds expression in speech, and when speech becomes contempt, it begins to dehumanize someone. See, in their culture, which is built around honor and shame, public insults became a damage to someone's social standing and their identity. But Jesus goes and presses in deeper than social consequences. Think of it back to Genesis 1:27. What does Jesus say? He says, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. When we reduce someone to a label, like worthless, a fool, we're not merely being rude. Instead, we are actually denying them the divine image stamped on them. That's why Jesus is escalating the language of the consequence. See, he's moving. He says that they're, you know, subject to judgment in the court, and now they're subject to judgment in a higher court. That's a Sanhedrin. And then he doesn't stop there. He goes, you know what? They're actually subject to judgment in the fires of hell. Now, the term translated hell here is Gehenna, which refers to a valley of Hinnom outside of Jerusalem. And historically, this was associated with idolatry, child sacrifice in Israel's dark days. But by Jesus' time, this had become a symbol of divine judgment and destruction. See, he's not exaggerating the just for effect. He's revealing that contempt is spiritually serious because it fractures the community God is building. See, what Jesus is doing here is he's not merely prohibiting anger. He's inviting them to imagine a different kind of world. See, in the kingdom of God, Jesus is describing in the Sermon on the Mount, the relationships are not governed by resentment, hostility, or simmering bitterness. Instead, they are shaped by mercy, by patience, and grace. In other words, Jesus is presenting this vision of life where anger no longer controls the heart. The kingdom he is describing to the people gathered is a world where reconciliation replaces retaliation, where humility replaces pride, and where love is stronger than offense. Jesus isn't simply saying, try harder not to be angry. He's showing us what life can look like when the goodness of God truly takes root in our heart. And the reason this matters so much is because anger has a way of clouding our vision. See, when anger settles over our heart, it begins to distort how we see everything around us. It begins to fog our spiritual eyesight. Suddenly, we no longer see other people as image bearers of God. We see them as problems, as enemies, as obstacles. The worst moment becomes when the defining lens through which we view our entire life, because then we no longer see the goodness of God in our own life. The truth is, we can strongly oppose someone's actions. We can oppose their attitudes or their decisions without denying their God-given dignity. Scripture has never asked us to pretend that wrongdoing is acceptable. In fact, the Bible consistently calls us to stand against injustice and sin and harm. But Jesus is teaching us that opposing someone's behavior is very different from allowing anger to redefine their worth. See, when anger takes control, we move from addressing actions to attacking identity. Instead of saying what you did was wrong, we begin to say you are worthless. And that shift is what Jesus is warning them about. God's goodness invites us into something better, invites us to see people the way he sees them. Even when someone's actions are wrong, even when their choices cause us and the world pain, they are still someone whom Christ died for. They are still someone who was made in God's image. And when we allow anger to dominate our hearts, we lose the ability to see that truth clearly. The goodness of God, however, restores our vision, teaches us to confront sin without surrendering compassion, to pursue justice without abandoning mercy, and to speak truth without losing love. That is the kind of heart Jesus is forming in his followers. That's why Paul wrote in Colossians 3 that believers were to put away things like anger and rage and malice, slander and filthy language. Why? Because we are putting on the new self, being renewed in the image of our Creator. Because God's goodness takes the heart seriously, because the heart shapes our speech, and our speech shapes our community. How many of you are on any form of social media? Any of these things may be listed up. Vast majority of people. This think about social media for a moment. A post could seem funny in the moment. A sarcastic comment or joke that you post on someone's wall that you send to them in a message could actually hurt someone deeply. Something as simple as clicking the like button on the wrong post can escalate tension. Small words repeated over time can shape hearts and relationships without anyone ever noticing. But God's goodness sees this and takes it seriously because he cares about what is forming in your heart, not just what others see. But understand here that Jesus is not policing our vocabulary. He's protecting the integrity of his kingdom. And in his goodness, he addresses contempt early, not to shame us, but to transform us. So maybe ask yourself these questions today. What words or attitudes in your life reveal hidden bitterness? And then, how can God transform those words into instruments of healing? Because God's goodness goes beneath the surface. God's goodness takes the heart seriously. And finally, God's goodness values reconciliation over religion. Look at verse 23 and 24. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First, go and be reconciled to them. Then come and offer your gift. The word therefore at the beginning connects this command directly to what Jesus has been teaching up to this point. Because anger and contempt are serious matters of the heart, but reconciliation has now become urgent. See, for the first century Jews, to bring a gift to the altar, they had to go to Jerusalem. For some, that could have been a 3, 4, 5 day journey. So think about that for a moment. Jesus is now telling you, you've made that 5 day journey, you're about to offer your sacrifice, but you remember someone's got something against you. You need to leave that. That person lives 6 days away. You've got to go, be reconciled with them, and then travel the 6 days back in order to do that. Because it's important. He values reconciliation over the acts of religion. How many of us show up on Sunday morning to worship God with a larger congregation, but there's someone that's got something against us that we haven't sought reconciliation? Should we go and seek that out before coming to offer our gift at the altar? I think so. See, Jesus sees that if during your worship you remember that someone has something against you, you're to leave your gift mid-process. Pursue the reconciliation first. Now, the Greek word to be reconciled is dialasso. It implies mutual change and restored relationship. It's active, it's intentional, and relational repair. But notice something striking in this passage. I didn't realize this the first time. And when I was in high school, I was on a performing arts team. We performed Godspell, the musical, which is the book of Matthew. And I was in a scene where I was a homeless man, and I was the one that had to be reconciled with. Someone had stolen my hat. And then they realized, oh, right, I have to leave my gift. I need to go and be reconciled to this homeless man, make things right before I come back. And even in that time in high school, I didn't realize this. But the passage doesn't say if you have something against someone else, go and be reconciled. It says if someone else has something against you, go and be reconciled first. Even if you aren't the offended party, you are responsible for pursuing peace when you become aware of that fracture. This reflects the very heart of the gospel. 2 Corinthians 5:18 says, all this is from God who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. See, the cross is the ultimate act of dialasso. God moved towards us while we were still sinners. Romans 12:18 echoes this in the same posture. If possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. To help us understand this, I think the best way to picture this is actually go back to the Old Testament to a guy named Joseph. We all know the story, right? Joseph had many brothers. Joseph was the favorite among the brothers. He got this special coat, and his brothers despised him for that. And they took him out, took the coat off, ripped it up, put goat's blood on it, went back to their father, said, "Oh, he's dead. We are so sorry." When they've actually betrayed their brother and sold him into slavery. And he ends up in Egypt and goes through a bunch of different situations, but then ends up escalating him to basically second in charge under Pharaoh. And God had given him these visions to help prepare for this upcoming famine that was coming. And then when that did happen, his brothers now had to come to Egypt to get food. And here they are, years later, years of suffering. And what does Joseph do? He could retaliate, but instead chooses reconciliation over revenge. Because when the moment came for him to reveal himself to his brothers, look at what he says. "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good." Joseph's life reminds us that God's goodness not only works in our hearts, but also empowers us to pursue restoration, even when it feels impossible. Joseph could have held on to that bitterness and demanded justice, but God's goodness guided him towards this restoration. See, Joseph was embodying this teaching of Jesus long before Jesus ever came to the earth to teach it. That's the heart of this passage, that God's goodness does not ignore brokenness. It moves toward restoration. Now, let's be honest, reconciliation is never easy. It requires humility, courage, and a willingness to be vulnerable. Maybe for our teenagers today, it might be apologizing to that friend after a fight. For our young adults, maybe it's repairing a strained friendship or a living situation. Or adults, you may need to reach out to that family member that you haven't talked to in years. Seniors, maybe releasing decades of unresolved bitterness in order to pursue peace. But just like Joseph, God's goodness can move us through the fear and pain to healing and restoration. And that's the heart of this passage, that God's goodness goes beneath the surface. God's goodness takes the heart seriously, and God's goodness values reconciliation over religion. Maybe ask yourself this morning, who is it that you need to be reconciled with? And when you think of that, then what is the first step that you can take towards peace? As Jesus concludes this section of his teaching, we begin to see the kind of world that he's inviting us into. Not a world where conflict never happens or where people never hurt each other. Jesus is realistic about the brokenness that we live in. But the world of God's kingdom is different because anger is not allowed to have the final word. In the kingdom of God, reconciliation becomes the defining pattern of life. Instead of resentment being carried for years, healing is pursued. Instead of bitterness being protected, grace is extended. And instead of relationships slowly eroding under the weight of unresolved hurt, people take courageous steps towards restoration. Take a moment and imagine what our communities, our schools, our families would look like if we truly lived in this way. Imagine families where disagreements didn't turn into lifelong divisions. Or friendships where pride did not prevent someone from saying, "I'm sorry." Imagine churches where reconciliation was pursued with the same urgency that Jesus describes here, where people were not willing to leave the altar, so to speak, to go and make things right. The world that Jesus is describing is not naive optimism. It's a vision of what life begins to look like when the goodness of God reshapes our heart. Because reconciliation does something powerful. It restores our ability to see one another clearly again. Anger clouds our vision, but reconciliation clears it. When we pursue peace, we begin to remember that the person standing in front of us is not just an offense they committed. They are someone who is loved by God, someone created in his image, someone whose story God is still working through. Reconciliation allows the goodness of God to break through the fog of resentment so we can see people again, not only through the lens that we once did, but through the lens of who God created them to be. And this is why Jesus places reconciliation at the center of worship. True worship is not just about the songs we sing. It's not about hands raised. It's not about the prayers we pray. It is about the heart being transformed by the goodness of God. Because when God truly heals our hearts, the healing begins to spill outwards into our relationships. The anger that once defined us begins to lose its grip, and in its place grows something stronger: mercy, peace, forgiveness, and grace. This is the kind of life that Jesus is inviting us into. A life where no anger no longer rules our hearts. A life where reconciliation becomes possible. A life where the goodness of God is not only something we believe about Him, but something that begins to shape the way that we treat one another every single day. Is it going to be easy? No. God never promised it was going to be easy. But His goodness promised that He was going to be with us through all of that. There are going to be seasons in your life where God and His goodness are going to be hard to find. Maybe you've gone through a season like that, but Jesus reminds us that God's goodness goes beneath the surface. It takes the heart seriously and calls us to reconciliation, even when it's uncomfortable, costly, and hard. As we close, I'm going to invite the band to come back up, and I want to give you a moment to kind of visualize this for a moment. If you're comfortable with it, close your eyes. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to talk to you. But I want you to imagine a season in your life where God's goodness was hard to find. Maybe it was vision clouded by anger, a broken relationship, the loss of a loved one. Now, in that time, imagine seeing a jar in front of you that was filled with a bunch of thank you notes. These notes that you had written to God over the years, some were easy, but some were written during dark seasons. But even when life felt heavy, opening that jar and reading those cards reminded you that God's been faithful to you all along. That's the reality that we get to live in today. You can open your eyes. In just a moment, the band's going to play, we're going to sing together The Goodness of God. No better song fitting for responding to this message today. But I want to do something that we did with our team last night at Wake Up the World, and I want to give you an opportunity to respond in a tangible way. You may have noticed when you walked in this table, it's filled with thank you cards over here. They aren't written to me. They aren't written to you. They are all blank inside. As we play this song, I would invite you to come up and take a card. If you need a pen, grab a pen and an envelope. Go back to your seat, and I want you to write a thank you card from yourself to God for the way He's been faithful, for the way He's been good, for what He has taught you through those dark times. I want you to put it in the envelope, seal it, and put your name on the outside because it's yours. And this is your break in case of emergency card. For when you find yourself in a season where anger is clouding your vision, when reconciliation seems impossible, where the goodness of God is hard to see, I want you to open that card, read it, and remind yourself how God has been good all the time, how He has been faithful in the seasons of darkness in your life. Maybe you have a friend that's going through a difficult season right now where they can't see God's goodness and His faithfulness and they can't see the hope. What if you could offer that to them today? Maybe take a card for them. Write a thank you note to God from them. Put their name on it and deliver it to them. But would you stand with us as we sing? As you fill out these cards, I want you to remember that even when we cannot trace God's hand, we can trust His heart. And His goodness is still healing ours today.